This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
You shall hear how Powerful Kiwis danced at Hiawatha's wedding. First he danced a solemn measure, treading softly like a panther. Then more swiftly and still swifter, whirling, spinning round in circles, leaping o'er the guests assemble, heading round and round the wigwam, till the leaves went whirling with him, like great snow drifts o'er the landscape.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. May has been Maestro Month, devoted to conductors not born in the U.S. but leading major American orchestras. The first week we chatted with the Frenchman Louis Langres, leading his Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, then the Finnish maestro Osmo Venska, music director of the Minnesota Orchestra. Last week, the Latin American-born Giancarlo Guerrero, leading the Nashville Symphony, and to conclude, a voice hopefully many of you have already heard a few weeks back at the end of April in the second episode of our bi-monthly series Post Classical, the co-founder and music director of Post Classical Ensemble, the Spanish-born maestro Ángel Gil Ordóñez. His innovative Washington, D.C.-based ensemble presents a rethinking of the concert experience through themed concerts that carry a narrative full of musical discovery for the audience. My guest co-founded Post Classical Ensemble with the noted music historian and author Joseph Horowitz, who along with Bill McLaughlin co-hosts our bi-monthly broadcasts. Post Classical's programs are some of the most important programming happening, and fortunately, they are documented on CDs and DVDs released on the Naxos label. You're listening to a selection from the recording Dvorak in America, with Joseph Horowitz and noted Dvorak scholar Michael Beckerman's concert work taking into account Dvorak's stated influence on his famous New World Symphony of Longfellow's The Song of Hiawatha, this movement Hiawatha's Wedding Feast, with narration by the noted bass and former Cadenza guest Kevin Dace, and the Post Classical Ensemble led by my guest, who was born into an intellectual and cultural-loving family in Spain. His parents, nonetheless, wanted him to pursue a career in civil engineering. He managed to compromise, but took the music path. He was mesmerized by a concert he saw, conducted by the iconic 20th century maestro, the Romanian Sergio Celibidache, which led him to study and become a conductor. Fortunately, and ironically, he would study with Celibidache in Munich. Leading orchestras and ensembles in both Spain and here in the U.S., the work my guest is doing with Post Classical Ensemble is important on many fronts and for the future of symphonic and classical music in America. I spoke with Maestro Ángel Gil Ordóñez down in D.C. last week.
Then the lodge began to tremble, and they felt it rising, rising slowly through the air ascending, from the darkness of the treetop forth into the dewy starlight. And behold, the wooden dishes all were changed to shells of scarlet. And behold, the earthen kettles all were changed to bowls of silver. All the sisters and their husbands changed to birds of various plumage. Some were jays, some were magpies, others thrushes, others blackbirds. And they hopped and sang and twittered, pecked and fluttered all their feathers, and their tails like fans unfolded. Then returned the youth and beauty of Owini the youngest. And her staff became a feather, yes, a shining silver feather. Such was Hiawatha's wedding. Such the dance of Paupukiwis. Such the story of Iagu. Such the songs of Chibiabos. Thus the wedding banquet ended, and the wedding guests departed.
I'm here today, very happy to be here today and to see you again with Maestro Angel Giordonez. Our listeners just heard you a few weeks back on our second broadcast of our bi-monthly post-classical series, and we'll look forward to hearing you in the future.
Absolutely.
But I want to start there. We're going to talk later in the interview about what post-classical is, why it exists, and what it presents. But first of all, let's get you hooked up with this ensemble and how you and Joe Horowitz got on each other's radar and how you came together to be for this musical marriage, as it were.
Absolutely. So I met Joe when he was the executive director of the Brooklyn Philharmonic in New York. It was 1997, and he was preparing a festival on flamenco. And he confessed to me, you know, I have no idea about flamenco. We met through a mutual friend. We had a wonderful breakfast. And he said that, I mean, I need your help because I'm fascinated by the genre. I'm fascinated when I listen to flamenco, but I need some help there. So it was very interesting. We had a fascinating conversation about flamenco music, about how flamenco influenced some of the most important Spanish composers of the beginning of the 20th century. And at the time, I was running an orchestra in Washington, D.C. The name was Musica Aperta. And I was very happy about how it was going. I was able to gather very good musicians in the area. But, you know, I was too focused on Spanish and Latin American music. So after that conversation with Joe, I also conducted in New York. He came to the performance. We became very good friends. So in, like, it was 97. So in 2001, actually, I also worked with a phenomenal group in New York, Perspectives Ensemble. Mm. We almost every year present some Spanish music in the year or Latin American music. So during those years, I thought, you know, Musica Aperta has to evolve. And this is when I said, I need your help to create a very good and innovative orchestra in Washington, D.C. So that was the beginning of the post-classical ensemble. Of course, he said, are you crazy? You know, typical reaction of Joe Horowitz. Every orchestra is failing. Just creating a new orchestra. And I told him, believe me, this is going to be, if I can count on your help, this is going to make a difference. And, you know, here we are 13 years later.
Was part of the fact that swayed Joe the fact that it wasn't going to be in New York? I mean, he was so jaded against the New York scene with what he'd been through with Brooklyn.
Yeah, we're talking about in 97, 98. Washington, D.C. is a completely different city culturally now than before. So in that sense, I had somehow a vision of how the city would change. And frankly, at that time, I didn't see much competition in creating something innovative, avant-garde. And I had read, you know, all the books that Joe wrote about how classical music has developed in the United States. And the first thing I thought is, I need somebody that knows the past in order to create the future.
Yeah.
And whatever person than Joe for that. Yeah. Somehow I had this vision of Washington becoming a place where a response to what was happening to orchestras in the United States can be. So, in the end, post-classical ensemble is a reaction to what is happening to orchestras all over the world.
Right.
So, that was the beginning of the adventure.
Here's my guest, Maestro Angel Gil Ordóñez, leading the New York-based Perspectives Ensemble in music of his fellow Spaniard, the late 20th century composer Xavier Manzavage, the final movement from his Concertino 1+13 from 1975. The soloist is violinist Timothy Fain, from whom we'll hear more later in the program.
listeners back in your career. You're very active, like you said, post-classical, but you still do Perspectives in New York. Are you also still doing Georgetown University?
Yes. So I'm also the music director at Georgetown University. I had somehow, although, you know, I'm a professional conductor and I have worked all my life with professionals, somehow I have been tied, which I like very much, with younger musicians. And actually, I was the director of orchestral studies at Wesleyan University for many years. Mm. And then, currently, I am the conductor, the music director of the Georgetown University Orchestra, which has been, to me, also very rewarding, because all the time I have worked with the students that were not music majors.
Right.
So I'm a great believer in liberal arts education. And both at Wesleyan, Wesleyan was an incredible experience for me, because my neighbors were in the rooms next to me in my offices. Alvin Lucier, Anthony Braxton. We had, as you know, at Wesleyan there was a fantastic ethnomusicology department. So we had Gamelan, both the most important Gamelan masters in the United States, Harjito and Somarsan. Mm-hmm. We had a Chinese ensemble, a phenomenal African drummer, jazz. So to me, as somebody educated in the Western tradition, there was also an incredible experience.
Wow.
I probably learned more than any student there in my state. And that also helped me to understand how music in the United States should develop too.
Let's do Georgetown, because Georgetown I also see is a bit analogous to, of course, we work so closely with Princeton.
Yes.
And that's the same thing, as most of those musicians in that orchestra,
yes,
in this program,
yes,
are not going into music. They're going into political science, they're going into science fields, they're going into mathematics, they're going into law. So it's a different perspective.
And it's great to work with them, because they are there, because they love music. So it's not like, you know, you have to take Orchestra 101.
It's a credit.
So they are there because they love it. I mean, imagine after all day of classes, I rehearse, I work with them on Monday and Wednesday at Georgetown from 8 to 10 p.m. So and they say, this is the best time of the day. So it's very rewarding.
Yeah.
You know? Although sometimes you hate them because they play flat, but that's okay. You know, I can live with that.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of education, it's funny when I was researching you, you had to make a decision with your parents. And what it struck me is so many of those biographies of those romantic composers who went off to school, usually in the Germanic countries,
yes,
and the parents wanted them to study law,
yes,
or they wanted to study medicine, think of Berlioz.
Exactly.
And somehow they got music in. They moved to music, thank God, because they're some of the greatest composers we've had. You had to make a decision. Just talk about the decision or the deal you made with your parents.
So in the end, now, after the fact, I can say what I did is actually I built a liberal arts education in my curriculum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what I did. So the difference is that I had to go to different spaces to learn music and then going to the university to learn a civil engineer. So it was, imagine Spain in the late 70s. Franco still was there. It was a completely different country as it is right now. But basically, the big contradiction in Spain is that being an extraordinary musical country, being a musician as a professional, was not very well regarded. Things right now are different, you know? So socially, everybody would say, okay, you study music, but what else?
Right.
Or, okay, you study music, but how do you make a living?
Right.
So, you know, internally also, for me, not only for my parents, I had to feel I have something that makes me somehow socially well-regarded. And this is why I studied that. I don't regret at all, you know, having been exposed to science and mathematics, etc. That has helped me immensely with the field. And then I went to Germany in 1885 to study with, we'll talk about this later. And then it was completely the contrary impression.
Right.
I arrived to Germany, and then suddenly I'm out. Being a musician was the socially well-regarded thing to be, you know?
Yeah, you and I discovered that we were actually in Germany about the same time.
It's true.
In Munich, and I remember
absolutely
when I moved there as a poor American kid. I went to the bank to open a bank account, and they said, what do you do?
Yes.
And I said, well, I don't know, Kunstler, which is artist in German. So she said, okay, that's fine. And she wrote down artist, and I almost fell out of my chair. So, exactly.
You were an artist, you were a Kunstler, and then
they would have said, no, for an occupation.
Yes.
But you had this kind of epiphany kind of for conducting because you saw one of the great 20th century iconic, sometimes eccentric maestros conduct, and you knew this is what I had to do. So go ahead.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it was April, I won't forget that date, April 1978. I was, you know, studying violin and harmony, etc., etc. And then this guy whom, you know, if you're, this is a very eccentric conductor, Sergiu Celibidache, the Romanian conductor, came to Madrid to lead the London Symphony. And I couldn't believe it, David. It was unbelievable. Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev. I've never, ever in my life heard an orchestra sound like this. Everything was there. Everything, you know, I learned later.
Right.
What was everything about? So to me, was that was an epiphany. And although I hadn't, you know, I had already done some choral conducting, etc., that experience was what actually led me to study conducting. And, you know, years later, I ended up in Germany studying with this guy.
Yeah. One of his quirks, because when you studied with him, you probably saw this up close and personal, he demanded a ton of rehearsal time,
yes.
Didn't he? I mean, it's out of the ordinary at times.
Absolutely.
So what did you take away from that? Because when you were probably around him in those European orchestras, which weren't union-bound as they are in the United States, that probably had its benefits. But I'm wondering what you took out of that once you came, especially when you came over here and you saw, that can't happen. He couldn't do it in London either. He couldn't go overtime.
He couldn't.
So, I mean, what did you take from his more eccentric traits that he had?
Well, he had so many things to say about music. For him, the rehearsals were actually a learning experience for everybody. So he approached rehearsals as we start a book. Even if we have read the book many times, we start the book from the beginning. Yeah. And we start from there. And we create an atmosphere. So I learned that what I love most than anything is rehearsing with an orchestra. This is the most extraordinary moment, which is discovering with others what music is about. And this is what was fascinated by him, that he would, you know, we started the experience, and then he would be controlling things and saying, but in the end, he was teaching to everybody how to listen to the others, which is the secret of conducting.
Right.
So in the end, is a symphony orchestra is chamber music.
Right.
And in the process, you are always teaching or advising how to accompany what is going on, because we are always accompanying something.
Right.
There's always some priority. This is what was fascinated by him, how to establish the priorities, how to listen to each other. And for that, you need time. For that, you need time. This is what we are losing. You know, one of the blessings of post-classical ensemble is I can rehearse as much as I can with my musicians. I mean, of course, the limit is the money.
Sure.
But we are one of the orchestras that rehearse more than anybody in the United States. Because I love the process is important.
Right. Well, plus, you know, you did the study with Celibidache, and he would have these long periods of rehearsals. But then you also embraced, and you know, not all conductors do, a lot of new music, a lot of contemporary music, which takes on a different time frame when you're teaching it to an ensemble, because you're all learning it together.
Absolutely.
I mean, just talk about that, because you have to change the principles of what Celibidache was doing, doing Prokofiev or Beethoven or whatever he was doing, Brahms. Now you're on equal footing with the ensemble in some way.
Well, but, you know, those principles actually are the same principles.
Okay.
Because in the end, when I approach a new piece, I apply the same principles of Beethoven 5th or, you know, Bruckner 9th. Because in the end, what we are trying to do is to discover together the process on how the music has written. So Celibidache said something that, to me, was crucial. Sound is not music. Sound can become music under specific circumstances. So this revealing how sound can become music is what makes the process of conducting or playing fascinating.
Mm.
So in the end, the last contemporary piece written has the same process as Beethoven 5th. What is music in the end? We are starting zero in silence. We create a tension, we develop that tension, the tension cannot develop anymore, the tension goes back, and we are back to zero, to silence. So this is the process we have to learn, and it's the same in every piece of music.
Of the many types of programs Post-Classical Ensemble presents, some of the most rewarding and important work has been the re-recording of soundtracks to films by major composers, which have been released on Naxos as audio CDs and DVDs with the restored film. From one of the two New Deal films produced during the FDR years with music by Virgil Thompson, one being The River, we'll hear music from The Plow That Broke the Plains. Here's the movement called War and the Tractor. The Post-Classical Ensemble is led by their co-founder and music director and my guest today, Ángel Gil Ordóñez.
Post-classical. You meet Joe, you do the flamenco thing. Joe, you get this idea, you say we need the orchestra. Joe says you're crazy, you form it. But now what is it going to do? And what post-classical is, you can correct me on this, but basically the tenet and the vision of post-classical is to create theme-based programs that offer the audience a new experience in concert going. Now, over the years, we're going to talk about the different parameters here, but over the years there's been programs themed about Dvorak in America, yeah. about Stravinsky, about Bernard Herrmann, about the Mexican composer Sebastián Revueltas. There's been projects of music that was connected to films and sort of redoing the films, refurbishing the films,
yes.
and then re-recording the soundtracks.
Yes.
I think of Virgil Thompson's to Roosevelt New Deal things, The Plow That Broke the Plains and The River. So these are these projects. How were they given birth?
So there are two ideas for the creation of post-classical ensemble. One of the things that really inspired me when I read some writings by Joe is a sentence by Theodor Thomas, this extraordinary German conductor who had an itinerant orchestra right. from the United States. And he said something that to me is crucial. An orchestra is the reflection of the culture of a community. So what is happening to the orchestras nowadays is they don't reflect the culture of the community anymore. Because the citizens in the 21st century are not the citizens of 50 years ago or 70 years ago. So what is not working anymore is not the classical music, it's the format of the concert. So what is not working anymore for specific audiences is to go to a place when you are listening to a Mozart overture, a piano concerto, there is an intermission, and then a symphony. That format is not working anymore.
Right.
And, or is working for specific things, but not as the usual thing to be. So this is why we are obsessed on going back to the sense of occasion of a performance. So how can we create an event, a musical event, in which we present the music that we love, but that contains the context to attract a different audience.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we create that context? This is what a post-classical ensemble is about. Another thing, why should the piece be presented complete? So, you know, exploring all this, exploring all the dimensions that you can bring to a performance to make that experience a special experience, this is what we are all about. And we are constantly researching on that. If dance is pertinent, we will have dance. If narration is pertinent, we will have dance. If visuals are pertinent, we will have visuals. Now, having a Tchaikovsky symphony with visuals, why? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, now everybody's putting visuals in the
right,
performance.
Right, right.
I mean, the visuals have to make a sense
right.
of that. So this is what we are about. We are about experimenting and bringing dimensions that will attract, for example, people that would come because they see there is a film that they haven't seen and there
right.
is music related to that, or there is a flamenco singer involved in the performance, or there is a gamelan involved in
right.
the performance. So all these elements bring a different audience.
But the core of the ideas, whatever they are, be they Dvorak in America
yes.
or like the Lou Harrison, which is what we broadcast, I mean, is this Joe thinks something up, bounces it off of you, and you guys sort of bring it together?
Exactly. Well, Joe is full of ideas
yeah,
all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
He knows music incredibly. So he's has been always very respectful with that. He has an idea, or I have an idea, and we always discuss that. And what he is really incredible is creating the narrative of
right.
the event, because that's the essential thing. In the end, we are always telling a story, which is what people need to know. We are telling a story. And you know, David, the best compliment that I receive after a performance is from the people, you know, we already have a wonderful group of followers that they tell me, when I come to your performances, I have no idea what is going to happen. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
This is precisely what we want,
right.
that people are surprised. So this surprise factor, to me, is essential to recover.
Well, we'll get to that. We're going to get back to the audience, because if you have you and Joe creating this, there are two other components here. One are the performers. You've got to get performers who are in some way sympathetic to what you're doing on the same wavelength. And these are professional musicians. They might play in other ensembles, as most do. But they have to come into these projects and buy into it.
And embrace them, absolutely.
Yeah. It can't just be you or Joe promoting it on stage.
No. He has taken us another 10 years to find the right musicians.
Wow, okay.
Because in Washington, there are phenomenal musicians everywhere. But people that really want to be part of this adventure, is not that easy. you know. So I'm very, very proud of the players that we have in the ensemble because they are excited to come to different things. They are part of the major orchestras in the area or phenomenal freelancers. That's the other thing. Extraordinary musicians are coming now to Washington, D.C. So we are blessed by that. We are always inviting new players to see how they feel about it. Fortunately, most of them come back, and it's really great.
Another invaluable film and soundtrack restoration, again available on DVD from Naxos and performed by Post Classical Ensemble, is the 1935 iconic Mexican film Redes, documenting workers' exploitation and revolt, here set in the fishing industry. The music is by 20th century Mexican composer Silvestre Revueltas. We'll hear the section called Good Fishing. My guest, Ángel Gil Ordóñez, conducts.
So now you have Joe, you have the idea, you have the theme, you have your musicians. Now it's a performance, so you have an audience. Now, thankfully, you guys have hooked up with Naxos and a number of these projects. Absolutely. Coming out on Naxos CDs or Naxos DVDs if they're the film.
Yes.
So they can reach people on their own time.
Yes.
But when you do these concerts live, and part of post-classical is to recreate the concert-going experience, the live music making.
Absolutely.
So since you started up till now, sort of how you've cultivated that audience, and I know that's a horrible way to put it, but it is true, because you're doing something different. So you had to tell the audience, hey, this isn't going to be your normal overture or new piece, concerto, yeah, symphony, go home, and everybody's happy, and you forget the concert the next day. That's not what this is about. So talk about how you've worked with the audience from the get-go, from, you know, 2002-03 all the way up,
yes,
through.
One thing that can be seen as a handicap has helped us immensely to create a following, which is we don't have a home.
Okay.
So not having a home, it's problematic, because the first thing that people ask me when I say I'm the music director of the post-classical ensemble, and said, oh yes, where do you perform? So somehow an orchestra has to have a place, and that's absolutely legitimate.
Yeah.
And we are looking for that too. But on the other hand, since we have been so itinerant, we have been somehow stealing audiences from many different places, the audiences that we are interested in. And that has been very rewarding, you know, from performing at the Library of Congress or at the Kennedy Center, at the Strathmore, or at, you know, the main venues. The Clarice Smith Center has been a wonderful host of ours for many years. And these people follow us. So right now, we are looking for a place. We are now in the work of something that they cannot announce yet, but
okay,
something will happen that might facilitate this. And of course, you know, you have to cultivate that audience. You have to be... So how do we do that? Pre-concert talks and post-concert discussion. This is something that nobody is obligated to attend, but they have to tell you. This is one of the things that, to me as a European, fascinates me about the United States, which is audiences want to know about things. In Europe, this is unthinkable.
Mm-hmm.
This is an American project. This is an American product. Post-classical ensemble would have been much more difficult to create in Europe, because in Europe, we all, who is this guy telling me what I, you know, what Beethoven is? So this American attitude, I really like it very much. So an audience has come to the pre-concert talks, and they stay after 2 hours for a post-concert discussion. This is unbelievable.
As you've seen the core audience of post-classical grow over the years, like you said, you've got people to follow you around these different venues. You've got to build your audience. That's
yes,
part and parcel with having a performing arts ensemble. And you also, I think, you know, the idea of new ears. You want to make sure that you keep your core people coming and they're
yes,
there. But you've got to build new ears.
Yes.
And let's talk about that just a little bit.
Well, it's true. I feel that my role as an artist in the 21st century is to guide the audiences to what they have to know, what they should be excited about. So in that sense, we don't want to be complacent with the audiences. So the audience that actually come to our performance is not the younger people. They come too.
Mm-hmm.
They come too. But I would say that our audiences are 30 years old and older. And what I'm interested is the audience that, to me, it has been always fascinating. I mean, more than fascinating, the right word is, I've been always amazed by the fact that how is it possible that people that go to an art gallery and spend hours watching the most abstract art, or people that go to films, or people that go to a theater performance of Shakespeare, hours and hours, and people that go to a jazz performance, and, you know, by a jazz, you know, specialist, and they go to a concert. This is the audience I want to go, I want to capture.
Right.
And these people are people that make an intellectual effort in all these experiences.
Right.
And why are not they attracted to classical music? Because they don't feel, they don't relate to that. So we need to create those relations. How do we bring those people here? Through film, through visual art, through theater. So we bring elements with which they are familiar with and they can relate. So this is the audience we are interested in.
From Post Classical Ensemble's most recent release on Naxos, in celebration of the centenary of American composer Lou Harrison, a disc featured on our most recent episode of our bi-monthly series Post Classical, which aired at the end of April, now up on our website as a webcast, which was hosted by Bill McLaughlin and Post Classical Ensemble's co-founder, noted music historian and author Joseph Horowitz, and my guest. This is the final movement from Harrison's Violin Concerto. The soloist, once again, we'll hear from Timothy Fain, and the Post Classical Ensemble is led by their co-founder and music director and my guest, Ángel Gil Ordóñez.
It's interesting because it's almost as if much of the audience that will go to a classical music concert doesn't know the language. And what you're doing with your type of programs, but other people approach it different ways. We do a program called What Makes It Great with Rob Capello, who explains the piece like Bernstein would do.
Sure.
What you're doing is you're building a story. You're building a narrative around this music and saying, follow this story with us, because it'll lead you someplace that you didn't know. It'll have you discover things. And along the way, you're going to hear some incredible music that goes along with this narrative. So, no crystal ball here in the room between us, but I mean, what do you project here? I mean, as you go, a few years out, 5 years out, 10, I mean, how do you see this just keep it going, or what's in your head as far as future?
Well, it sounds terribly arrogant. We are the future. This is the future. Flexibility also in some of the programs we have, 13 players. In some of the programs we have 40, 50, 60. So, yes, creating in collaboration. We like to do festivals around a theme. So we collaborate with the film division of the National Gallery of Art, with a museum. Those events, that's also the secret of the 21st century, is collaborating within the arts. So I think that as long as we keep going this way, there is a future for classical music. What you said before is essential. We are obsessed with the life experience of music. We have to preserve this. So anything that can be done in that sense, I applaud it.
Yeah, you have to embrace today. For those interested, you, 2014, you did a TEDx talk about Revueltas, the Mexican composer. You played some music, talked about it, shared some visuals of him and some from a letter. So that's out there too. And again, that just reaches a different audience who, like you said, many of them are not spending their money to go to a classical orchestral symphonic concert. It's just not, it's not what they want to do. It's not how they want to spend their time, and time is precious. So, well, you know, keep going. I'm glad that we've got you every other month doing what this is, so people on our end, thousands more, can hear it than what you can get into your concert halls down here in D.C. But sky's the limit with something like this, right?
Because, absolutely, you know, yes.
You're at a Joe's head. Those are the limit. I close on my cadence interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been doing, but with someone from the past, pick their brain. When I ask that, what's the first name that pops into your head?
Well, Bach, of course, is the
Bach.
First. Yes.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Because one of the things that I somehow regret with the Romanticism is that we have lost this idea of the musician as a worker. And I like to talk with somebody that is able to write with a specific purpose every week.
That would be Bach.
That would be Bach.
Yeah.
I love that. I love the guy that is sitting and saying, my goodness, this Saturday, the oboist is in Leipzig, and then the baritone is sick, so what I do, and I write this fantastic cantata. I'm fascinated by that. And I think we have to recover that. I feel very much, as a conductor, as somebody that has a place in society, as, you know, a conveyor important thing. So more than an artist, we have to get back to the idea of, this is my job. And I love that.
Right.
And I love my job. You know,
yeah.
But so that would be one person. Do you need one more name?
You could take one more, sure.
Then I think, because of you know, my years with Celi Vidache, I would be fascinated to have a talk with Anton Bruckner. Probably one of the shyest person in the world, because I'm fascinated by his symphonies. This is probably my next task in the United States. I want to advocate more for Bruckner. I mean, with the post-classical ensemble, of course, it's very difficult because, you know, we don't have the forces so far right now for that. But I think it's a composer that needs to be also better known here in the United States.
Yeah, it's interesting because over the years of Cadenza, when I have great maestros on, Mahler. Bach is the number one answer from everybody by far.
Yeah.
But Mahler is the answer many conductors turn to. But recently I've had a couple of conductors, including yourself, talk about Bruckner. Like, there's this kind of reawakening. Let's reevaluate.
Yes.
you know, his symphonies came out, they were disparaged, whatever, and then they went away. Then they came back with recordings and the sonic world.
Mm-hmm.
But now he needs to be reevaluated on musical world. And I think, you know, so I think you might be right. It's everything cyclic in music, right? Yes, everything is cyclic in music. Final question is, everybody I interview at Cadenza fills their life with music. You are very busy. But when you have to do something non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do? Do you need to just get a little respite, take yourself away from music for a while?
Well, of course, I mean, family is first. I like very much walking. I'm a walker, you know. I like that. I like nature. I don't listen to classical music.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm in my free time, I actually cannot stand it. Because I'm working there. Nature is beautiful. I think this is probably the best time for me to spend free time, you know, with the family and then friends. Friends. This is probably the best sport ever, you know, having a good conversation with friends and a good Spanish wine. What a better way to spend your life than that.
Do you live someplace down here in D.C. where you can get to nature? I mean, there are some beautiful places
around
here.
Well, you know, this is one of the things about Washington, D.C., that, I mean, we are surrounded by nature.
Yeah.
And the Rockley Park actually divides the city. So you don't have to make much effort to have a nice walk. Actually, you know, my years in Munich, that was also very beautiful. I learned how beautiful it is to bike everywhere. I'm not biking in Washington, D.C. I miss that. Maybe I should start doing that here in Washington.
Yeah. it can be safe. Anil Giordonis, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you so much, David. It was a wonderful pleasure.
Maestro Angel Gil Ordóñez, co-founder and music director of the Washington, D.C.-based Post-Classical Ensemble. The CD and DVD recordings of Post-Classical Ensemble can be found on the Naxos label. Check them out at naxos.com. You can find out more about my guest and Post-Classical Ensemble at their website, postclassical.com. The next episode of our bi-monthly series, Post-Classical, with hosts Bill McLaughlin of Exploring Music and co-founder of Post-Classical Ensemble, noted music historian and author Joseph Horowitz, and my guest, will air Friday, June 30th at 8 p.m. And it will feature Post-Classical Ensemble's Dvorak in America project, of which there is a Naxos recording. As we heard at the outset, the main work being the Hiawatha Melodrama, put together by Joseph Horowitz and noted Dvorak scholar Michael Beckerman, arranged by my guest, drawing from the fact that Dvorak admitted being highly influenced by Longfellow's poem The Song of Hiawatha in composing his famous New World Symphony. I hope you can tune in for this fascinating broadcast, and I'll leave you with the final and closing movement, the epilogue, Hiawatha's Departure. The voice is that of celebrated bass Kevin Dace. The Post-Classical Ensemble is led by their co-founder and music director and my guest today, Angel Gil Ordóñez. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.
By the shore of Gitchigumi, Hiawatha stood and waited. Gone was every trace of sorrow. As of one who in a vision sees what is to be, but is not. On the shore stood Hiawatha, launched his birch canoe for sailing, sailed into the fiery sunset, sailed into the dusk of evening. Thus departed Hiawatha in the purple mists of evening, to the regions of the home wind, to the land of the here.